we obviously didn't want to do this. There was other ways we could have got there, but we had to, and we did it, and we won. And hopefully we don't need to go through something like this again.
A jubilant day for the Yes campaign. The same-sex marriage vote gets up 62-38 in the national plebiscite.
When Australia responded to Vietnamese asylum seekers, the policy drove the politics. Whereas today, the politics drives the policy, and we can see that that leads absolutely nowhere.
And how our attitude towards asylum seekers has changed over the last 40 years. Hello and welcome to The Wire, current affairs across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Luke Radford in Adelaide. Also today, the story of the Mungo Man, Australia's oldest Indigenous remains returned to their traditional home in Western Australia. And we talked to Senate newcomer and youngest representative in the Australian Parliament, Jordan Steele John. Stay with us for the next half hour on The Wire. But first today, the results of the same-sex marriage survey show over 60% of Australians voted yes for marriage equality. The ACT had the highest response rate of yes voters with 74%, and New South Wales recorded the lowest yes vote with almost 58%. Every state saw scenes of rejoicing. In Adelaide, heavy rain didn't deter the celebration of the yes vote. The Wire's Chris Dastour and Catherine Andrews went down to the event.
Zane Dean emceed the Yes campaign rally at Adelaide's Hindmarsh Square this morning and announced the decision at 10 a.m.
I don't think I can say on radio. I was not sure that my underwear would make it. I was very nervous. I could feel my stomach turning and tying itself into knots, and I really didn't know which way it was going to go, and I don't think anyone did. And I mean, I was just trying to prepare myself for either situation. How was I going to react if it was a no and everyone became inconsolable? How would we react if it was a yes and everyone was celebrating?
Caitlin Georgeson is the SA Equality Campaign field organiser, and she says it was important to connect with the voting base rather than let the issue play out in the media.
This kind of campaign can't really be a top-down kind of thing. Obviously, it needs to be coordinated out of headquarters, but it's the only way that this is going to succeed is from a grassroots movement. So we recognise that from the get-go, and we mobilised hundreds of volunteers here in South Australia. We door-knocked, we made phone calls, we had conversations, we handed out flyers, and we just made sure that we were a touch point for the campaign for local people in South Australia.
Marriage equality proponents had been critical of using the plebiscite for this purpose, and there will be significant healing required in the aftermath of the campaign.
I'm not going to say that there were no bullies from the Yes campaign, because it's a campaign that took over the whole country. Of course you're going to get some bad seeds, just as there were bad seeds with the No campaign, graffitiing and vandalising and beating people up and committing acts of violence. I think overall the spirit of the equality campaign was about equality and about unity, and yeah, we might have been forceful because we were upset and we were scared and we were having a debate about our very rights, and it took a toll on all of us. So, you know, if people were expecting us to be polite and sweet and ask them super, super nicely, well, no. Have a bit of, like, respect and have a bit of understanding and empathy for what we're going through, because we're not actually insulting you. We're just telling you this is what the deal is. We need yes votes. And I think overall the tone of the campaign was not a bullying one.
Yes or no, this campaign was always going to be really rough for a lot of people, and I think we just need to remind ourselves that getting a yes result is really important, but we need to keep looking out for the people that this campaign has been really hard on. There are 17 electorates in Australia, which isn't many, but there are 17 where no was the predominant result. We really need to be looking out for people that are LGBTI in those electorates in the coming weeks and months, and just recognising that this isn't a fix-all for equality for LGBTI Australians, and just also pushing through that legislation in Parliament is just going to be so important.
SA Yes campaign manager Emmanuel Cusack was happy to have contributed to the cause, but maintains there were still better ways to deliver marriage equality.
We obviously didn't want to do this. There was other ways we could have got there, but we had to, and we did it, and we won. And hopefully we don't need to go through something like this again. But it was a very good result today, and it's been great to see, especially here in South Australia, such a resounding yes.
Look, I'm not sure what we would replace this with other than just the old democratic system of parliamentarians voting on behalf of their constituents. But look, that's a conversation that I think Australia is going to need to have, because they need to recognise how difficult this has been and how unscientific this survey was.
Liberal Senator Dean Smith has introduced a bill this afternoon win, with Labor and the Greens expected to support it.
It's phenomenal, the result that came through, which shows that Australians back marriage equality and want the government to get on with it and want politicians to get on with it. So we expect Dean Smith's bill to be supported and that passed by the end of the year.
Emmanuel Cusack, SA Yes Campaign Manager, finishing that report by The Wire's Chris Dastoor and Catherine Andrews.
After a hard day out in the paddock, I like to catch up with The Wire. Find out what's going on around this big country.
The Wire, bringing you the stories from all around Australia.
And now Sam Bradbrook from the newsroom is here with today's headlines. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Luke.
So first, let's go to Zimbabwe. Things are looking worrisome in the capital.
They sure are. Tensions are escalating in Zimbabwe's capital of Harare, where the country's ruling party has accused the head of the military of treason. Explosions were heard throughout the capital, and the latest is that military personnel have taken over the country's state television station. A spokesperson had this to say on ZBC.
We wish to make it abundantly clear that this is not a military takeover of government. What the Zimbabwe Defence Forces is doing is to pacify a degenerating political, social and economic situation in our country, which, if not addressed, may result in a violent conflict. Let it be clear that we intend to address the human security threats in our country. Therefore, any provocation will be met with an appropriate response.
And now to Manus Island. What's the latest with the unfolding situation?
There is perhaps a rare glimmer of hope for the hundreds of asylum seekers on Manus Island. New Zealand have offered to spend nearly $3 million on returning basic services to the detention centre. The refugees on the island have been without food, water or electricity for 16 days now. People are getting more and more desperate. They refuse to leave for the new camps built by the PNG and Australian governments as photos emerge showing them as incomplete. Kate Schutze from Amnesty International told us the latest.
Some of the water tanks were being destroyed at the centre at Lombrum by the PNG authorities, which again is very alarming. And we have a real concern that some of them are likely to run out of medicines this week as well. Whilst there's resistance on the part of the PNG and the Australian government to do anything to change the situation in Lombrum, it's difficult to see how more money at this problem is actually going to fix anything. What they absolutely need right now is resettlement options in a safe country. It's very clear that PNG cannot provide that.
And finally, a big case in environmental law is going to federal court.
Now, this could be a massive win for environmental law. A possum is the centre of a federal court injunction to ask for a halt to logging in 34 zones that are home to endangered Australian animals. Lawyers from Environmental Justice Australia will allege that logging in native forests has been going on for decades exempt from federal environmental law. Environmental Justice Australia CEO Brendan Sides says that companies must be held accountable.
The case comes about because of a situation under our National Environment Protection Law, the EPBC Act, or Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, where the threatened species protections that would normally apply don't apply in the case of forestry because of what are called regional forest agreements. The outcome that's sought in the case is that logging is prevented from occurring in 34 areas that we and our clients have identified good habitat for Leadbeater's possum in the Greater Glider, and also recognising that this issue is not a new one, that there be some requirement to mitigate the impact from unlawful past logging that's occurred. A similar number of sites.
And another twist in the dual citizenship saga.
It just never ends. Holly Hughes has been ruled ineligible to replace Fiona Nash, who herself was ruled ineligible due to being a dual citizen. And that's all from the newsroom for today.
Thanks, Sam. The Mungo Man is the oldest archaeological remains in human history. The remains are thousands of decades old, but have been held in Canberra since their discovery 43 years ago. They are now being returned, along with other ancient remains, to their traditional lands in rural New South Wales. The Wire's Cody Chiasis reports.
The Mungo Man laid peacefully in the Wollundra Lake region for 42,000 years, until he was dug up as part of an archaeological dig in 1974. But today, he began his journey home. CEO of World Weavers, Ben Bowler, is running a festival in Mildura, which will celebrate the return of the remains. This has been a lifetime passion for the entrepreneur. His dad, Jim Bowler, was the one who discovered the body.
It's a moment of coming together. Indigenous Australia, the elders have welcomed everybody in to this moment where we can acknowledge and honour, you know, Aboriginal Australia's the oldest living culture on the planet. And here's Mungo Man, who's a symbol for that very thing, who's finally, after 40 years away from home, has been returned to country. So something that we come together to celebrate as a community, and certainly the local, you know, community here has had a tremendous reception to that. We're expecting it to be a fantastic night.
Do you feel that's a significant event for such important remains to be given up by the ANU and back to its traditional owners?
Of course, it's been a long time coming. 43 years taken for this to happen. There were a series of events. Last, I think in late 2016 it was, that the human remain, that the Mungo Man was handed from the ANU to the museum, the National Museum, in preparation for this, you know, final leg back to Mungo National Park. So it's been a process, and it's been a series of getting to that process, and now we're here, and he's left, he's on his way. He left Canberra a few hours ago this morning.
How did you become involved with the operation?
We grew up with it because my dad, Professor Jim Bowler, who's the scientist who first discovered Mungo Man. Mungo Man revealed himself to Jim on the shores of the lake in the early 70s, 1974. So we've grown up with this our whole life, and so this pending moment of when Mungo Man returns to country has been coming for such a long time. We were there in 1992 when Mungo Lady was returned to the National Park. And so this moment's been coming for such a long time. We wanted to make sure that when it happened, that we could, as a community, come together and make the most of it. And that's where we went to the Aboriginal elders and asked if they would like for there to be a commemorative event. And they all unanimously wanted that to happen. So that's how I personally got involved in it.
Maureen Raylan is a member of the Multi-Multi community where the Mungo Man came from, and is part of the group that has travelled to Canberra to retrieve the body. She says it means a lot to her community that the remains are returning to their original resting place.
It's been taking a long time for this to happen, and we are just really, really... There's no words that can describe our feelings for bringing Ben Mungo home and our ancestors home. It's just amazing feeling that we are part of this journey, and that my mother, Alice Kelly, started over 40 years ago in honour of me mum, and passed this on to us, and to go through to, you know, to bring our ancestors home. And we're very privileged to do that and walk in our mother's shoes.
For our listeners, what does a traditional burial look like in your culture?
He's going home to country in a secure place at Lake Mungo National Park. They're coming home to country for the time being until what happens with the burial, which we use down the track. Because our main concern was to get him home first, and there'll be another round of meetings next year when we decide when we're going to lay them to rest back in the womb of Mother Earth. All us Aboriginal people in Australia just stand proud today, tomorrow and Friday when he goes through country. It's very symbolic. It's very symbolic, and it's absolutely beautiful that we are doing this, and in the respect for my mother and the other ladies on the past who fought so hard in the past to have our ancestors brought home.
Dr. Claire Higgins, historian and senior research associate at the Caldor Centre for International Refugee Law. Oh, sorry, wrong one. No, apologies for that, guys. Speaking to The Wire's Bonnie Parker. Oh, this is just ID. The Wire on Community and Indigenous Radio across Australia. And hello if you're listening in on the Karma Network, 100.5 FM, location at Alice Springs, or the Daly River Community, 102.9 FM at Daly River, or even the Fink Community at 102.9 FM out at Fink. Last Monday, the Australian Electoral Commission conducted three special recounts in New South Wales, Queensland and Western Australia. They needed to identify replacements for the four senators who lost their seats due to holding dual citizenship. Thanks to the recount, Canberra now has its first senator from Western Australia with a disability. 23-year-old Jordan Steele John has cerebral palsy, but that hasn't held him back. He's already a veteran in playing the political game, so the Wired's Jared McLaughlin asked him the questions that all politicians now dread.
I know you, Jordan, have said this numerous times, but have you rescinded your British citizenship?
I can very much understand why people would ask the question. I sound like I've just bounced off the set of a British soap opera. But no, I am 100% Australian owned and operated material.
That's great to know. What challenges have you encountered at Parliament House so far?
There's been quite a few of them, Jared. We've had some challenges with, obviously, Senate procedure, which we've had to have a little bit modified, and some challenges around physical elements, such as, you know, the desk heights and the fact that you have to go down a step to get to the seat, and doorway width and things like that. But the staff here at APH have been absolutely fantastic. They've worked together with me really well to make the changes necessary. And I'm thrilled that APH is a more physically accessible place for us working together on that. And I think more broadly, you have to ask yourself the question why there has been so few people with a disability serving our federal parliament, and why, you know, it takes till now for us to think about those changes that are needed and what that says about how society views people with a disability.
What issues do you believe haven't been covered by the major political parties?
Well, I think there are many policy areas that get sort of covered, if you want to define that as they talk about them. What I find more distressing is the issues that they talk about, they kind of spasm rhetorically toward the need to do something, and then they actually propose something that either does nothing, makes it worse, or does as little as possible. And I think one of the key examples of that is around the housing crisis we've got in Australia at the moment. We've got a situation where, you know, 200,000 people sit an average of 5 years on our social housing waiting list. We have 10,000 people homeless in WA alone. We have rents increasing, you know, between 88 and today, between 40, about 44%. And yet there is a complete deficit of action from the Labour or Liberal parties in relation to actually addressing the issue and acting on things such as negative gearing and capital gains tax, which are creating this problem and locking my generation particularly out of the housing market.
Yeah, and it's the same for my generation as well, which is probably around the same as yours, because I'm also Gen Y, and I feel that I can't get a foot into the door to be able to afford to live somewhere.
Exactly. I mean, look, we're in a perverse situation now, where I, as the senator for WA, is one of the only people of our generation who can conceivably look down the barrel of the next couple of years and think that I might be able to move into the housing market. It shouldn't be that you have to be on a wage such as a senator is paid to be able to afford the human right of a roof over your head.
Yes, indeed. And do you imagine yourself being a short-term or a long-term decision and lawmaker?
I'm hoping to serve in the WA Senate for as long as the electors of WA and the membership of the Greens WA want to keep me in this position. I think I bring some valuable perspectives, but I'm also somebody who's incredibly focused on bringing other people into the political process. As far as I'm concerned, politics needs to be about us and not about me. So I'm really looking forward to the time period ahead, and it'll be up to others to decide, really, on how long that period is.
That was Jordan Steele John, Western Australia's newest and youngest senator, speaking to The Wire's Jared McLaughlin. In the 70s, 2,000 Vietnamese asylum seekers arrived to Australia by boat and were welcomed by the then Fraser government. The government went on to resettle tens of thousands more Indochinese refugees, a moment that's often remembered as a positive one in Australians' history. Now the government's catch cry is stop the boats. So what's changed in the past 40 years? That's the question historian Dr. Claire Higgins is trying to answer in her book Asylum by Boat, Origins of Australia's Refugee Policy. The Wire's Bonnie Parker asked her when immigration became a political issue here in Australia.
In the late 70s and early 80s, you had the sustained arrival of Indochinese, mostly Vietnamese, by boat, and then there was a break for a few years. And then asylum seekers began to arrive by boat again in in the late 80s and then through the 90s and into the 2000s. And that coincided with a backlash against non-discriminatory immigration to Australia more generally and the demographic change in the community. Immigration became a politicised issue. The two major parties have usually avoided politicising immigration, but it became sort of politically profitable to do that. And asylum seekers, this area of policy, bore the brunt of that. And the reason being is that Australia has a large immigration program and it's non-discriminatory, as it should be. And so, therefore, government, in order to reassure the public that immigration is controlled and orderly and carefully planned, take a hard line on what is really, in comparison to other countries, a very small number of people arriving by boat without valid visas, these asylum seekers. And so they've sort of become the focal point for community anxieties about unplanned entry to Australia.
Your research includes interviews with former Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser and other key figures in immigration at the time. How did they reflect back on this time in Australia's history?
Yes, I was lucky enough to interview Mr Fraser and his former immigration ministers, Michael McKellar and Ian McPhee, and all of them were appalled at the direction that policy had taken in recent years because, as they saw it and as they handled it when they were in government, Australia needs to work with the international community to manage forced migration. Australia can't go it alone with a hard and restrictive approach. That is a dead end, as we have seen in recent weeks on Manus Island, as just one example. They were very much interested in Australia taking a constructive, multilateral approach, a rational approach to this issue.
Taking us back to the current situation, of course, detention is a major issue at the moment with the situation on Manus Island. But originally, the idea of mandatory detention was rejected. Why was that?
So, Bonnie, one of the most interesting things I found when I was researching the book is that those ideas about, okay, what will happen if thousands of Vietnamese sail to Australia, how will we manage people? There were suggestions for placing people in forms of detention or other kinds of facilities. And this was partly an international discussion over whether which particular countries would host camps that UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, would help run. But in Australia, it was also seen as potentially a way of deterring asylum seekers. And one of the most important things I found was consistent evidence within the Department of Immigration records that this idea of detention was rejected, and it was rejected for four reasons, and they still stand today. They are still the reasons why it should be rejected today. And the first was that detention would create a political problem, and we've seen that borne out. The second was that detention would not deter asylum seekers, and we've seen that borne out. The third was that detention would not provide a genuine answer to the issue of forced migration, and we can see that. And the fourth, which I think is most prescient, the Secretary of the Department of Immigration at that time, he told a public audience in Canberra that there is no way that Australia could detain asylum seekers indefinitely without a tremendous, as he called it, a tremendous guard apparatus. You can guess that he would never have imagined the billion-dollar securitised immigration detention system that we have today, but he was absolutely right, and that is what it would require, and that is what it has been borne out, much to the detriment of the mental health of people who are detained and Australia's international standing.
To look back at your book now, you've done all this research over the period of time. How can exploring the history of Australia's immigration be used to approach it in a contemporary context?
I think it's incredibly useful because we have to understand how Australian policy got to the point at which it is today. And while the hard line against asylum seekers and the harsh rhetoric, that might seem normal now, but history shows that it isn't normal. It wasn't always this way. And that government can take a rational, principled approach to the issue, an approach that encourages positive public opinion and through which Australia works constructively with other countries and upholds its international responsibilities. If we sort of look at it very simply, the period that I was looking at when Australia responded to Vietnamese asylum seekers, the policy drove the politics, whereas today the politics drives the policy, and we can see that that leads absolutely nowhere.
Dr. Claire Higgins, historian and senior research associate at the Caldor Centre for International Refugee Law at UNSW, speaking to The Wire's Bonnie Parker about her book Asylum by Boat, Origins of Australia's Refugee Policy, published by New South Publishing. And that's it for The Wire today. The Wire is a co-production between 2SER in Sydney, 4EB in Brisbane and Radio Adelaide. You can hear The Wire weekdays, same time, on your local station. And we have a website, www.thewire.org.au, where you can find audio and details of any of our stories. You can also find us on Twitter. Just search for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio Adelaide. I'm Luke Redford. Thanks for your company.
Ideas. Music. 2SER 107.3.
boo.